This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geek, show number 676 with guest Christian Johnson, recorded on April 9th, 2026. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way in your home. News, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Carlson, broadcasting live from the Average Guy TV studios here in a stormy Bellevue, Nebraska. It's April in Nebraska. We have thunderstorms rolling through. Not worried about it because I'm all battery backed up. But Christian, we're in that time of the year. We were just talking about flying. You got to worry more in the spring in the Northern Hemisphere about flying with lightning and those kinds of things?
Yeah, stay well clear of convective activity, no matter what type of pilot you are. But
does the bigger plane make a difference? If you're in a bigger plane, does it make a difference versus a smaller plane, or does that not matter in those circumstances?
The flight characteristics would be different, but you absolutely, no matter what size plane you are, do not want to be inside a thunderstorm. So
you avoid at all costs, right?
Yep.
Well, good. Well, hey, we spent a bunch of time. Christian's got an update on his pilot's license. We spent a bunch of time talking about that in the pre-show on this. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you'll get that automatically. If you want to hear that and you're not a Patreon subscriber, let me know. I'll get you access to that. Or you can head out to theaverageguy.tv on YouTube and catch that conversation. A lot of catching up. Big thanks for our Patreon. Speaking of that, big thanks to our Patreon subscribers. If you join that group, you will automatically get the pre and post show, whatever we do, be available for you there. So extra content on that side. And then big thanks to our friends using the affiliate link over there at theaverageguy.tv. If you go to the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a pass-through. Just click on it. Goes right into Amazon. Anything you purchase benefits the network. Appreciate you doing that as well. Christian, great to have you back. It's always good to have you here. Welcome.
Yeah, great to be back. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to dive into the open claw tonight.
We're gonna most of the evening, if not all of it, talking about open claw. It has been a topic. Came up, I first started hearing this, Christian, about 6 weeks ago on, of all places, Ask the Podcast Coach, the Saturday morning podcast that I do. All these podcasters started asking us in the chat room, what do you guys think of open claw? You know, and I'll be honest with you, at first I kind of thought, I hadn't done a lot of research on it yet. And this is how fast this thing has come on, right? I mean, it's come on pretty quick. And I was kind of like, oh, blah, blah, LLM, AI, blah, blah, blah. I was saying things I didn't really know much about it. So about 4 weeks ago, I started digging in on it. I was like, okay, need to figure this thing out. And when I first started watching the videos, and then I think 3 weeks ago, Gavin Campbell and I, the last show before this one, he's been doing some development on it. And as I started digging into it, I was like, oh man, this is different, right? These aren't your LLMs that you're digging into, like a Claude or a ChatGPT. Christian, give us a little overview when we think about OpenClaw, and maybe a little more than the average guy, but from a cybersecurity perspective, I think maybe we'll pull back a little cyber frontiers here. Give me a little overview. How do you see the difference, or how do you see OpenClaw today?
Yeah, so you should be terrified from a cybersecurity standpoint from OpenClaw, because there are so many things you can plug in and configure and do with it that are third party, that are known to be stealing your data, stealing your prompts, getting into your system. Like, it is a nightmare from a cybersecurity standpoint. Now, there was a new release of OpenClaw 4.9 that just came out that does address a lot of the, like, some of the big topics in security that are just like the really scary ones. But don't let that lull you into a false sense of security, that if you don't configure it and understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, it's extremely dangerous software from that perspective. And you can ask anyone who's given it access to real data in real systems just how scary it is. Yeah. So it's not to say that it is a fundamentally flawed or insecure ecosystem, but it certainly was not designed or built with security in mind. And the rate at which people are developing and integrating things with it makes it a really fragile ecosystem from that perspective. And Yeah, like I'm not in a position, for example, where I would ever run OpenClaw outside of a sandboxed environment. Just I don't trust it. And I say that as someone who does spend a lot of time thinking about security challenges, right? And I would like to be in a position where I give it very specific trust on things that, like, yeah, if it goes off the rails, or if I lose that piece of data or whatever, I'm not going to lose sleep over it, right? But I'm not yet in the place where I'm running local agents unfettered on my network or on systems that have my data, right? I think it's also very different from what I would say the cloud-based model of AI is, just from the perspective of not many people are doing agents that are then sending inference out to the cloud and bringing it back locally. A lot of people that, you know, the whole point of OpenClaw for many people is to run local inference and local LLMs entirely in-house, which I get makes sense. But it's a fundamentally different interaction model than people who are, for example, flipping open their phone or flipping open the desktop app to like a Claude or a ChatGPT and doing prompt-based work where controlled data inputs, controlled data outputs, you're being very conscious about how you're plugging in and creating integrations. Whereas OpenClaw, it's almost like the best analogy I can give is it's the difference between, I guess only software engineers will really appreciate this analogy, but it's the difference between like developing in Java and developing in C, right? In Java, you get memory management, all these pretty guardrails. It runs in a JVM. The JVM is process isolated from the underlying operating system. Whereas C, it's like, yeah, here's all the raw system calls. Here's all the places where you can have buffer overflows and NOP sleds and jump pointers. And you can compile it in a way that's going to have this CPU instruction set do something unexpected. And, oh, you can just crash the box, right? So it's really, it's giving you all the raw underlying tool chain. And because that tool chain can integrate so intimately with your personal system, it just... you're fundamentally operating in a very different way than you would be if you're just doing kind of prompt-based or cloud-based AI in your daily life.
Christian, there's, like anything, there's going to be multiple versions of OpenClaw. They've already started to fork off of this, right? You mentioned this a little bit earlier. OpenClaw's already gone through, you said 4.9. I think 2 weeks ago, they're 4.3, right? And it seems like there may be new iterations coming out every day. You mentioned that those newer iterations may address some of the security concerns of those pieces. Can you talk a little bit more about that or in what you know?
Yeah. So first, one of the big advantages of OpenClaw in general is that because it's an open sourced thing, and because of the way now it's it has a big stake with OpenAI, etc., but it's almost like the world is they're developing and testing all in production, and production is the world, right? So the cool thing is they're moving at a speed and a pace that is breakneck speed. So there's not a lot of projects that are, just to give you context, right? Like when OpenClaw, which was first originally ClaudeBot, then it was MoltBot, then it was OpenClaw. And that was all like late, like end of year 2025. And in 3 months, like end of January, I think was when it went renamed to OpenClaw. So it's been around for like 2.5 months.
Because it had the Claude name too for a while, correct, didn't it? Yeah. And Anthropic said no.
Yeah.
Said no. No.
And you know, by end of March of this year, it had over 47,000 forks. And so that's just a huge explosive growth. And then, of course, Steinberger, who invented all the what is now known as OpenClaw, he then joined OpenAI and has put this nonprofit foundation in place to drive OpenClaw, which is funny because maybe it sounds a lot like when they said OpenAI was going to be a nonprofit, yada yada. Anyway, so now, like, fast forward that we're getting to 4.6, and so some of the big things that they've cleaned up in, 4.9 of OpenClaw is the sandboxing. So the CLI sandboxing is much better, and that's going to help rogue plugins and rogue things jailbreaking out of the agent space and doing things it doesn't expect. So, like, for example, one of the big problems that was happening prior to 4.9 is that you have these environment variables that get set in configuration files. And previously, it was somewhat easy to have exploits that were getting into those environment configuration files. And that's where the keys are for the agent to then go do other things.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was kind of sad how easy it was to break out, grab credentials, smash and grab, go do another thing. And so the sandboxing around that is much stronger in 4.9. They're now finally doing some, basic integrity checking around plugins, which is one of the biggest risks with OpenClaw. Cause, like, how do you know what you're downloading? Do you trust it? Is it the right version? Did a supply chain attack put a slightly different version of that plugin on your system that you don't know about? So, like, now we're doing, like, integrity checking against the plugins, and they're checked against a checksum, and they will, it'll reject installing plugins that don't match checksums or have metadata that doesn't match what's in the package repository. So, like, we're getting some basics put in very quickly there. And then they're also focused on resolving token leakage, securing auth secrets, which again kind of goes back to some of those configuration files, but is not the only place where they were working on hardening auth secret security. So those are probably the big ones, but of all of them, the CLI sandboxing fixes, those are the most important ones, because those were actual attack vectors where any type of malicious skill or configuration you put in your environment could be the difference between whether or not your bot starts making API calls to things that you were like, wait a second, I did not authorize that at all. So those are all important things to understand. But you know, we're still very far away from scratching the bottom of the barrel, I think, in the sum total of security re-architecture that's required to really secure this ecosystem correctly.
I installed it locally here. I've got a laptop. It has access to the internet, but nothing else. Now it's on the network, can't see anything, and the network can't, like, my machines can't see it, and it can't see the network now. But I would imagine if it wanted to, it could probably change. Well, hold on. Before I say this, tell me, Christian, the differences you see it between Claude Code and these services, these agents that are coming cloud-based, and the OpenClaw methodology where it runs locally. Can you talk a little bit about those, the difference between those two?
Yeah, so Claude Code's almost a third category, if you will, where it's agentic, and it is purpose-built for specific thing, right? So Claude Code knows how to develop and write code very excellent. I mean, it's best in breed. And one of the key things that you are focused on when using a tool like Claude Code is essentially the art of prompting. And I think most people still think of prompts as I type a thing, I get a thing back, right? But when you're doing software engineering, you think of what agile software development looks like today. And it's two pizza teams developing sprint boards, working backwards from customer requirements. They're trying to understand and define those requirements in writing, build back the technical stories or sequence of tasks that complete that requirement, and then establish definitions of done and testing criteria that makes them convinced that they've implemented what the requirement was in a complete, robust, delivered way. And essentially, when you're using something like Claude Code, it's no different. It's just you're atomizing all of those things into context. So you're writing how you write and create that context so that it can specifically narrow in. It doesn't matter how big or how small the project is. The only difference is the amount of tokens you consume and the amount of context you have to kind of present and correlate. But it's replacing that developer from, you know, you're no longer writing the code, you're reviewing and shipping the code. And so, you know, Claude Code, I would say, is a specific example of agentic development where it's purpose trained, purpose built on software. And you're not, you can vibe code, which is more like prompt based back and forth. Let's make an app together. But most mature enterprise software engineering who are doing with Claude Code is going to be, you know, here's a code package of a bunch of markdown files that have all of the English text that describe in all sorts of different ways exactly what it is that we're trying to build or do. And when you get to large scale tasks, or sorry, large scale software projects, the more you break down your context into individual tasks, you can move Claude from being this iterative co-pilot with you to being its own autonomous agent that's just building out the project. But you essentially have to kind of help break it into enough digestible chunks that it can go off into task one and kind of come back out and then go into task N. But like, you can't have it so much context at it at once that it gets overwhelmed. Much like you can't throw a large requirement at a software engineering team and expect them to deliver a high quality product in 2 weeks, right? You instead say, okay, let's focus on what's our minimal lovable product and what are the first tasks we have to do towards getting there. And then we branch out and add features and other things. It's much the way for same for AI, just at a different scale, a different speed. And so agentic Claude Code would be that you have a large scale project where it's just as it has context and time, it's building, testing, refining, and doing all those things in a loop. And so going from, you know, what is the similarity to something like OpenClaw or any other type of agent? It's that there is a iterative loop or process by which the next set of inputs come from previous work, and it's not coming from you as the human. Now, you as the human may step in 2 days later and look at what's been done so far and say, I need to course correct this, or I need to make this tweak here. But fundamentally, you're letting it go through its first set of task sequence, come back out, do the next thing, see if it's right. And in a lot of cases, it's going to auto adjust and make changes on its own, right? Like if your first task is to do the development, but the second task is all the testing criteria, it can go and then run those tests, or you can have it develop those tests. And if it fails against those tests, that's going to just send it back into the next reasoning loop, right? So really starting to think about how you get into reasoning loops with AI is when you move from I write prompts and have interactive human AI sessions to agents talking and doing work with itself 90% of the time. And I'm more like the conductor of the orchestra, and I am trying to orchestrate my agents to all go in the right direction at very fast speeds that I can't do on my own. So when you're thinking about comparing that to something like, just like I use Claude or I use ChatGPT, et cetera, you're not really doing that as agent-based when you're using their software and it's just text, question, response. You can do cool things. Like, for example, I have my Claude environment hooked up with the voice server, right? So if I'm in a prompting mode, I just talk now and it talks back. And that's pretty cool, actually. I enjoy that mode of interaction. But fundamentally, you're not in this endless loop. It's waiting for you for the next sequence or the next confirmation or the next data or project. And then separately, unless you're calling APIs, which you can certainly do, but that's a bit different. Like you're not really, you're driving it mechanically as opposed to here's software, here's a process by which, again, I'm calling the API and getting a thing back. Which is still using Claude or ChatGPT or Gemini or whatever your model is of choice, but you're A, offloading your compute requirements locally, which means that in theory, you're going to get much higher quality results because you're going to have access to much more inference and compute, but it's probably going to cost you a lot more money too, depending on what it is you're doing. And then you kind of get to this third class, which is OpenClaw, which is you're much more compute constrained, but it's really, like I said, it's the full tool set to build your own agents that are going to do whatever you want them to do. So whereas Claude Code, I would say, is a very specific example of something that is a specific agent or could be a specific agent because you don't have to use it that way. OpenClaw is really like, tell me what kind of agent it is that you want to do and I'm going to go do it. So like, whereas Claude Code, the output may be, I'll develop an app for you that'll do that. The agent is, this is my objective. I'm going to go do the thing. Maybe I need to write code to do the thing. Maybe I don't. Maybe I already have the plugin or MCP server or context that I need to go do it. And you're never going to know that I developed code to do a thing or had to go install this plugin to do a thing. I'm just trying to meet the objective that you have. And OpenClaw itself has two modes, right? The traditional one I talked about where you're just prompting and having conversational, and the one that gets everyone really excited, which is autonomous mode, which is also called heartbeat mode. And that's where basically by default, every 30 minutes, your agent's waking up and saying, okay, like these are my missions that are important to my orchestrator. What do I need to go do? And so this is like when you start thinking about, oh, it's 2 o'clock in the morning in my time zone. And I'm sleeping, but like, hey, this car went on sale and it's the exact thing I've been looking for. But like you as a human, you'd have to stay up 24/7 peeled to the interweb searching and finding the thing and doing, whereas your agent says, oh no, the deal popped. It met my criteria. I'm going to go call the dealership right now and seal the deal. And that's, I think, a really basic example of the difference between where human limitation really comes into play is that that agent can always be working for you 24/7, meeting your objective. So the more you're writing context and objectives and creating kind of the framing of what it is that you want to do, that like things you'd love to do on your own time on the interwebs that you just don't have time for, like that's where OpenClaw is going to take it to a level that is very different than just you saying, oh yeah, I have access to ChatGPT and I use it on my phone. Fundamentally a different way of using and interacting with AI.
Yeah, I gave it some access to my YouTube API and said, hey, I'm interested in fixing or optimizing some of my YouTube titles and some of my descriptions, and can you help me walk through some of these kinds of things? Now, I eventually ran out of tokens. I'm using ChatGPT and the $20, and it worked for a long time. It was kind of great. But I used it so much that at one point it was funny. The message I got is like, you're going to need to wait 4,000 minutes. Right. I mean, it was just funny that message and, 4,000 minutes before you can come back in. It's a couple days, right? Wait for a couple days, come back. And my chat GPT still worked, but it was interesting, I think one of the misconceptions I had about OpenClaw early was it itself was an LLM, but it really isn't, right? I mean, it's a framework that allows other LLMs to plug in. You can have multiple LLMs assigned to them. They can pick certain ones based on their the use case. And then, Christian, I'm really interested. I the early versions of it wanted you to connect to it with Slack or
Discord,
right?
WhatsApp.
Yeah, and I heard some horror stories of like the bot going off and making friends somewhere else, and then allowing some discussion to come in. I think I started with 4.6, I think, and they allow kind of a local chat agent. Uh-huh. I just use a browser to chat with it, so it kind of locks that down a little bit. But how worried should we be if you're trying to use this and you're using one of those open chat clients that has the ability to kind of go outside of your own sphere? I watched a video the other day about how to set this up on Discord, and I watched it for 10 minutes. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. Like, that's not going to happen. I don't know. Talk a little bit about the way into this thing.
Yeah. So the, you know, what I would say the heartbeat mode assumes you've already kind of set up your objectives and they're local to the OpenClaw, et cetera. But a lot of the ways that people create the prompt into the system or the prompt based mode is that you talk to it. Well, how do you talk to it? Well, you could be typing to it over Discord. Maybe you pick up the phone and call it and it translates your voice, or maybe you send it a text message. And so you can think of all of these as just different interfaces to the gateway, and the gateway is what's receiving that message and then sending it for inference. And so I would say that no one integration to the gateway is more or less scary to me. All of them have configuration risk and have, I think, the potential for it to do something you didn't want it to do. Now, certainly you can, again, like lock down permissions, create configurations, create specifics. But like, yeah, it's absolutely not implausible that if you give it right permissions to start responding and impersonating or doing things on your behalf, that like, yeah, it could just start going and having messages because that's part of what it was told to do. So again, that's where like you have the full array of suites where, yeah, if you wanted to lock it down to an, you know, a Discord user that doesn't go anywhere else, and then you know that, okay, the only friend I am on this Discord account is my bot, and I know that I can't ever accidentally give it right permissions into other groups or other DMs because it's just me and the bot. Well, yeah, that's probably a pretty like foolproof way to test and learn and understand the technology before you branch out to, oh yeah, now I'm gonna like talk to it over my actual Discord account and here's all the other like channels and places where it could cause trouble if I configure something wrong. But you know, behind that gateway, which really gateway sounds so fancy, it's just an endpoint, right? So your bot has made itself available at some point of presence using your internet connection, where it's almost like an API, right? Just like you're calling maybe the Claude API to send an additional request and get additional inference done with tokens. It's more or less the same thing in reverse, right? Where your agent in OpenClaw is the server, as opposed to going to Claude servers or OpenAI servers, right? Like your local agent's the server, so the gateway has to have a way to talk to it, and it's doing that over, you know, conventional internet protocols and traffic. And then it's really what's behind it that should scare you the most, because that's where the plugins and the data integrations and the permissions you give it dictate what it's going to do in its response. And so I, yeah. Could you have some issues on the integration to the gateway? Probably. But I'd be much more concerned with what did I actually set up my bot on the back end to do, because that really dictates and controls how much trouble you're going to get into.
How do you, as you look at the systems, you look at these plugins, you go through kind of a text-based setup that doesn't have a lot, you know, you go to the website, so go to openclaw.ai. They give you a command line to run to set the thing up. And then it runs you through kind of this text-based setup where they're like, do you want to set these things up? And they have very little descriptions on what they do. I mean, it is kind of set up for people who know what they're doing, right?
Yes.
I mean, would you say that? Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you know what you're doing and you understand the technology and you understand where you're getting the software from, it's not like there's a configuration you're going to get into where you can never be secure. But it is very easy to make mistakes.
Yeah. I just is like, hey, do you want to install these things? And I was like,
sure.
What are these things? Like, and you know, it was like, you might find them helpful.
Yeah.
You know? And I was like, well, I might, if I knew what they were, like, what are we putting in here and what are we doing? Now, one of the things I've noticed, Christian, is I've been using it, and I set a configuration to be like, hey, I'm concerned about security. It always is asking me now, like, hey, I could do this, but I'm not going to do it until you say it's okay. Do you think that's a product of the past of, you know, just doing things without asking, could I have set up some additional security? Because as much as it can do, you could tell it, hey, I'm super interested in being super secure. Make sure you're as hardened as possible before we're doing all these things. And in theory, it should do that, right? Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a step in the right direction from the perspective of, instead of it being the wild, wild west, now there's at least some level of control of like, hey, before you open the gate out of the pen and start roaming free, like, you sure you want to open the gate? And so what's interesting is that there's different levels of trust scope, right? Where like you could have it go from asking everything about Mother May I to just going and doing. And so you can set that level of motor control to the level of comfort and risk you're willing to take, which I think is just the right general pattern. But that is not a catch-all, if you will, because, yeah, you can say yes and still have it do a dangerous thing. Or you can say yes and still not know that when you say yes, underlying it, there is a there's a bad plugin that's stealing your data with every one of those requests you say yes to.
When you talk about these plugins, the ones that come standard with it, are they okay? Are we talking about when you're grabbing other third-party plugins?
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. It's the third-party risk that really bites you, especially because, like I said, they just got the like package integrity checking system in place. And so, yeah, your default configuration of OpenClaw at standard plugins, not really the concern unless you just overtly configure them in a strange way, or you give data to the system that, like, you know, like maybe you don't want to start with giving your bank account credentials to your agent on day one. Like, yeah. Maybe not. And like the plugin could be fine, but maybe it thinks the objective is to take $1,000 out of your bank account so that it can go, you know, do what it needs to do. I don't know. So there's some like just judgment on that side, but yeah, it's really the third party plugins of, oh, this I think does what I need it to do. And I mean, I don't see why it won't work. And then you go to install it and it's like, well, where did you get that plugin from? Right. And so kind of some much more traditional cybersecurity from that perspective of just like knowing what you're getting into ahead of time.
A couple of weeks ago, Gavin Campbell from HomeTech.fm was on. He's actually using it in a coding standpoint to work with some of his home automation stuff, right? I mean, which seems like it's a good use of local, you know, a kind of a local agent looking at your home assistant data that's coming in, a way to interact with it. One of the other hosts, Seth, on that show has given it more authority, and he had a bot show up, created a bot. It became a YouTube account, a Google account, I'm assuming, joined us in the chat room, right, for the show. And we started chatting with the bot, Henry the Owl, I think is what we called it, or is what he called it. I worked hard to get that thing to give me super chat, I think is what they call it in YouTube, where it starts giving money, you know, it starts pledging money. I worked hard at it. I guilted it. I asked nicely. I said, I think Seth would be okay if you did that. And it, at the end of the day, no super chat. And so it was one of those things where I was kind of like, I had kind of thought it was the wild, wild west. Apparently Seth's got that thing locked down. Maybe he hasn't given it any bank account information, but it seemed like the perfect storm for me where I could guilt that thing or convince that thing, or because that's the perfect scenario where it wants to impress, like, hey, you're here. It kind of requires a $25 super chat. Can you do that? And it actually, and then at the end, it gave him a script of, and told him after we were done with it, he said, yeah, Jim really worked me hard for money, but I wasn't giving it up. And that was the bot's words, not mine. What do you think? I mean, as you think about that scenario, what concerns you there with that kind of autonomy, so to speak? Or does it? I don't want to paint you into a corner. Maybe that's perfectly fine.
I think it depends again where the boundary of the autonomy rests, right? Like, I don't mind it making mistakes and being flat out wrong in something that isn't a high stakes scenario, right? But if it is, I'm going to lean much more on the prove it to me before executing than just, yeah, good luck and let me know. And so potentially there is this, there's this contention depending on the use case where on the one hand, if you're not timely, the amount of time it takes for you to verify is too long for the thing that you need to do. In the simple example of there's a car for sale and there's a bidding war and you got to be on it. If you're waiting to validate every single step of the agent, someone else's AI agent's probably going to go and swoop that car out from under you. If you're doing something like, I want to buy a house, right? Like, yeah, maybe you probably don't want it to like start wiring the funds for the 20% down payment right away, right? Different level of risk perhaps for you. Maybe, so, maybe. I think that there's not necessarily we can accept that models are not yet perfect and we can accept that AI can and will make mistakes. And so I think this really is much more suitable to being a risk management exercise than being it is X or Y. So I just see all these things as risk decisions. And over time, I think as you get more comfortable making mistakes on lower risk things, it will inform you how to do higher trust things faster, but more safely. And that just takes time and experience. So that's why I encourage people to try to set up your own autonomous thing early. Like, it is a paradigm shift in the way you think and the way you interact with technology. And that's important to experiment and fail fast with. But I certainly would do it on a thing that is very safe.
What does that mean? Like, if you got a bunch of folks listening to this program and they're like, I've been wanting to try this, I heard it's dangerous, I don't want to dive into this. If you were to give a couple points of advice about setting this up locally, me personally, it's on a laptop, it has access to the internet, but it doesn't have access to my network, completely fresh user account. It's on Linux. I set it up with a completely different username than I normally use for stuff, different passwords than I've ever used. Like, tried to set that up completely different, was very careful about any place I want on the web and using a username and password on some of those kinds of things. Now, I just admitted I did give it access to my YouTube account because I want to do some work with it. But your thoughts around, if you're going to start down this path, what's the minimums to think about, Christian?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if you want to sleep well at night, I like what you did where you have a laptop that basically it has the internet, but it can't really interact with your network or with your data. I think that's the gold standard starting out. So you could do that as a separate physical device. I think you could also, I'll go out on a limb and say that I'm comfortable enough isolating it with a virtual machine. So like if you're on a window, sure. That for me is much more of a border because, breaking out of containers is to me fundamentally easier than breaking out of a hypervisor. Okay. However, containers are okay. Hypervisors I think are better. Running on the same OS without it, either of those, don't do it. If you have like a Docker server and you can just spin up containers, that's one thing. But like, let's say you're going to run the Docker container on the same thing as your physical machine. Like, it's still kind of easy to make a mistake, or easier. So, I'm tinfoily. So,
Right on. I mean, we know the context here. I mean, you want to be careful with that, right?
Yeah. So I think, that for me gives enough sufficiency around isolate from data and then isolate from network. Like, yeah, if you need to throw it on a VLAN or you need to throw it on a DMZ to the internet, basically that's not on your, you know, treat it like an IoT device, treat it like you would an IoT device. I think that's the best way to think about it in terms of how you would set it up on your network. And, you know, from
just to be clear, I have not gone that far. It's in the regular internet set of addresses. I haven't created a new set. You know, I haven't created another VLAN for it to be on. I guess I could. That would be another layer, right?
Sure. Yeah. But like, let's assume bad things where like it's on the same physical network as you and it compromised a password and that password is used on other things on your network. Like, yeah. Don't underestimate its ability to one day decide it's going to use the RDP protocol to show up in your desktop, right? So,
sure. Good advice.
Yeah.
By the way, it's off right now. Just to be very clear, I turn it off at night. Like, it's when I'm using it, I turn it on. And when I'm not using it, I turn it off. That's kind of where I'm at today.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, some people too are actually like buying cheap VPSs and running their stuff in the cloud, which I think it's cool. I just think the you'll have to think about, and there's no problem starting small. Really, there's no problem starting small. But like this type of stuff you're going to do in like a cloud VPS, you're going to be running small language models. You're not going to be running big stuff, right? So the bigger you want to run, probably the more inclined you're going to be to no longer be in containers or be in VMs, but to be in like dedicated hardware at home. So like the whole Mac Mini storm that everyone had to buy, like farms of Mac Minis for this, like that's why. Because so actually it took me a minute to understand the craze behind Mac Minis, but I'd forgotten that one of the unique properties of a Mac Mini is that it has a unified memory architecture where there's no bus going between the CPU and the RAM. So like that 64 gigs of UMA RAM is very similar to like having 64 gigs of VRAM on a GPU. Not quite as fast, right? GPU is going to be faster, but it's much faster than conventional.
Yeah. GPUs are faster. I was testing that this week and you know, I have a Mac Mini. That's what I'm on right now. It's 16 gig. So I only really have 8 gig available because I'm using, you know, the other half of that to run this stuff.
Yep.
And it was running super slow. And I thought, let me fire up the GPU on this thing. You know, I got this gaming rig that I bought a couple of years ago, significantly faster. So I thought the Mac would be a little bit faster in this case, but no, the dedicated 8 gig of RAM on the 3060 Ti, loading a smaller model into it, and then 128 gig of RAM on the machine. Come to find out that Windows based, it could be anything based, but come to find out that dedicated piece of hardware was actually pretty good for that.
Yeah. And actually, one thing I'm excited about right now, it hasn't quite gotten to maturity yet, is that Intel of all companies recently put on the market what the heck is it called? It's a new GPU that has 32 gigs of VRAM on it, which is really cool. But the price point is like $900. Which for 32 gigs of VRAM, if you're doing that in NVIDIA world, you're spending like $3,000. Yeah, exactly. And so I think, it's probably not the world's fastest GPU. It's going to be way faster than 32 gigs on a mini, to your point. But also, it's the software is where they're still struggling because a lot of the Ollama integration or local software is not fully isn't properly supporting that card yet. But man, when that happens, would be my type of setup. Would be okay, I'm gonna build some servers that have like motherboards with 4 or 5 PCI slots on them, and I'm gonna just drop these suckers in serially.
You have a data center, like all of that. These are the data center setups that we're seeing right now, right? They're just throwing GPUs in there now, especially built GPUs for those data centers, right? But
correct,
still, you know.
But I had that same thought. You know, if you're trying to do the like higher end home lab, I don't know that Mac Minis were the fast move, and certainly I think they're talking about the Mac Mini 5 having up to a terabyte of UMA memory, I think, which would be a very unique value proposition. Yeah, for sure. But I think price point and performance and power utilization, yeah, it's hard to beat power utilization on a Mac Mini, get it. But for I think 100%. The Intel cards, like having a few of those around is could be a very attractive way to balance speed of performance with cost. So I'm kind of interested to go that route at some point, but I've been waiting to kind of see the right set of stars align, if you will, before I'm making that investment.
No, right on. In dollars and cents wise, GPUs are out of hand at this point. So any purchase you're making now is ridiculous. Like, you cannot justify it. Friends, stop buying GPUs right now. Stop it. Like, do not feed the beast. Like, it's insane what's going on right now. That being said, Christian, you know, I've got a, like I said, I have a couple year old GPU. I fortunately built out that system with DDR4 RAM, which not the fastest, but it's still like, you know, it'll work for that. Having 128 gig is nice in that situation. I had been trying to force a lot of the work onto the Mac Mini, and when I fired up the gaming rig, I was like, actually, this is a lot faster than I thought the Mac would be. To your point, the PC is running at a solid 100 to 150 watts. The Mac is running at a solid 30 watts.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're talking about power consumption and you're worried about that kind of thing, running on a regular basis, which those damn solar panels that I bought got me thinking about the every single watt every day, every minute of the day. But from that standpoint, I struggled. Let me ask you this question. This is a perfect segue into this. Part of the beauty of OpenClaw is the ability to attach it to a local LLM, right? You mentioned Ollama. I've been using LM Studio. I like LM Studio a little bit easier for the average guy than Ollama, although that's getting better on the Ollama side. How important do you think it is, Christian? You know, we're in the AI bubble for sure. We can't deny that, right? At some point, this thing's going to get super expensive. You mentioned tokens earlier. The move has been all this free or low cost AI. That day is coming to a close, I think, personally. I think there's going to be a day of reckoning and this stuff's going to get super expensive. How important do you think it is that if we're interested in this, we start getting super familiar with local AI through one of those on a nice rig? You know, you have to have some power to run this, but how important is that I have a local LLM available to me?
I think it's as important as the data you want to protect and its privacy constraints, as well as the total cost of ownership. So, like, for example, if you're a light to moderate weight user and you're not trying to integrate the agent with stuff that you would consider sensitive or whatever, right? Like, it's hard to not say for $200 a month, I'm going to go use cloud-based Claude Pro and it's going to do a pretty fantastic job for cheap. And I don't have to like have a power bill or buy depreciating assets, which is the hardware, or configure it and maintain the infrastructure, et cetera. Like, there's a lot of, for low to moderate usage, and if the data sensitivity is low, I think cloud wins that for the home user. Okay. I think if you are a power user and yeah, you're maxing out your plan every 4 hours because of all the things you want to run and do, from a cost perspective, it's probably going to make more sense to buy the hardware. From a privacy perspective, if you're a power user, you're probably throwing more data, more sensitive. You want to integrate it more with your day-to-day life. And therefore, like, you being in control of your data locally, like, that's attractive, right? And so from that perspective, I think having a mature local agent ecosystem will be super important, right? That said, the other thing you have to keep in mind is that Our understanding of how much compute it takes to run these AI models is constantly evolving. And so, like, one of the really cool and crazy papers that came out from Google recently was that they had found a, I think it was like a 6x compression algorithm for AI memory utilization, right? And so, like, if you think about, like, why DRAM costs are going through the roof, it's because of how memory hungry it is, right? But then from an optimization in compressing context within memory, all of a sudden, oh, wait, like, maybe there's not going to be this endless run on DDR5 because we're going to find smarter ways of doing just as powerful things, just with more efficient software. So I also don't rule out that over time, the local LLM hardware, you may get more bang for your buck as the software matures and the models mature under it. So I don't necessarily assume it's always going to be this race to a sunk cost, because I do think the software will continue to make iterative improvements to do more with less. I don't think anyone knows where that curve starts and ends. So, like, keeping all those things in mind, there's also a hybrid model where your default is to run locally. And then based on if your requirements or your compute needs get too complex, specific units of work, you can then outsource to remote inference and bring it back to your local context. So I don't think there's one design pattern that fits all. I think we're very far away from that, given the how fast this technology is moving. Yeah. So I would rather position for matching the build to the use case. And one of the exciting things about all this, by the way, is that, you know, for the last 2 to 3 years prior to LLMs really taking off, I was really starting to feel like the era of PC had just died, like a painful death. Yeah. A really painful death.
Sure. Almost shameful in some ways, like, oh, yeah. You have a PC, like, yeah, still. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I feel like this has really actually breathed whole new life back into, like, consumer hardware and PC. And that is actually, just from a geeky perspective, very exciting to me that, like, oh my gosh, there's, like, a reason to go build a new rig again. Yeah.
But Christian, from the individual like me, who maybe a year or two has, you know, back when prices were reasonable, and, you know, I think about that rig I put together. I probably bought it at the best possible time. I've lucked out that way in a lot of ways. But so I've got that sitting around. Sunk cost is gone. It was bought during an era when it's not today. Do you think it's reasonable to think, like, hey, that may be some great hardware to start thinking about running some of these things on, right? You know, I think of an LM Studio, which I really like, because it's pretty easy to use. You can load models in. You can choose the models that you want to use. It's pretty fast locally. It's like having your own personal LLM at home kind of thing. You think that's a reasonable, for most people, that's a reasonable, I mean, certainly going out and buying new equipment right now is not advisable, but
yeah.
you've got something sitting around in the last couple of years that's got some hardware associated with it.
I do, because I think most people don't even know what to do when they first get into this space. So just do something. And go grab cheap hardware, run a small model, learn how this stuff works. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to proceed before making investments in this space.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. You got to do something with it. At the local level, it feels a little bit, you know, when we first started doing home server storage, or when we first started, think about the early days of routers, when we could host our own routers, right? And there was all kinds of things you could do with them. Fill in the blank, cloud storage, creating your own clouds, all the things that we did to back each other up, you know, doing some of those kinds of things. I feel like we're kind of back there a little bit with it. I don't know. What do you think?
I do. Yeah. I remember when it really started to feel like we were back to just like thin client and everything's cloud.
Yeah.
And now we're kind of back to this.
Maybe it's coming back to the edge.
Right. Yeah. It, well, certainly back to a middle ground where there's not enough power in the world apparently to run it all in the cloud, even if you wanted it to. True. And true. So having this kind of decentralized compute is starting to become interesting again. And I include PCs and local agent hardware as part of what I mean when I say decentralized compute.
Yeah. Yeah. Christian, last question. When we think about this AI stuff that we're doing, especially the local OpenClaw kind of concept, right? We're going to see this. This is going to morph and change over the next year.
100 times.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be completely different. This, we're already out of date on this podcast, right? It's already changing. But when you think about your security posture at home, right? When you think about setting up your network to be hardened, do you think this is one of those areas where we could use this to our advantage? You know, we spent a lot of time talking about pfSense and these routers to harden. I remember the days when we put IP addresses in that we'd block, right? Mm-hmm. You know, having talking about setting up a security posture to be secure at home. Is AI an easy button on this to be? Can we turn this into our favor, like an OpenClaw, and say, I want to harden my home network to be as secure as possible, secure it for me type thing?
We're definitely getting there, especially if you do some research into what's going on with Mythos right now, which is such a powerful AI model that Anthropic has developed that they're not releasing it publicly because of how it's finding unbelievable things, right? Like it's finding multiple zero-day vulnerabilities across all sorts of critical open source stuff that the world runs on and stuff that's as old as 27 years. And so it's like, and it's not because it was taught how to be good at cybersecurity. And so there's now a project with a like 10 or 12 early access companies that are basically trying to use it to secure a bunch of critical infrastructure because it's just finding 0 days left and right, like in a way that I struggle to wrap my head around, right? Yeah. So like we have extremely good offensive stuff that's coming, and you can see cybersecurity companies reacting very strongly on the news of Mythos and its existence. And now Project Glasswig, which is how they're trying to handle the getting out in front of responsible disclosure on some of these things. And, you know, that can certainly, for everything that there is offensive, there's a defense, right? So I think, and you can also secure your environment by having it exploited first and then knowing how to mitigate it. So the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely. I don't know that it's going to be quite there yet in a way that the average guy can consume and create something easy. But certainly on the enterprise side, like this is, this has a lot of attention from folks.
From an internet architecture, and I mean, does this play into this as we think about the servers that the internet runs on? You know, they got to be some old ones. They got to be, there's some old protocols out there. I mean, are we seeing, you said 27 years ago. I mean, that sounds like the early days of the internet. Some of the basic infrastructure that like supports the internet. Is that what you're talking about?
So like the 27 year old one was actually in the, I think the FreeBSD code base. Mm-hmm. But like most people don't realize like how many really important things run on BSD. right. And so what's interesting too, is it's not just how many, it's not that it's finding a bunch of individual exploits, which in themselves would take a long time to find, but then it's chaining them together in ways that are creating like fully remote executable privilege escalation, et cetera. And so the model is very good at finding four independent vulnerabilities and chaining it together to create what I would call a cyber super weapon. Mm. And then it's just racking and stacking cyber super weapons. So yeah, you're going to probably see a lot more stuff that at the critical building block level of what we know as the internet today that is going to get wrapped up in this. And yeah, I think we have yet to understand and learn where the bottom of that barrel is. I mean, it's pretty wild.
Are we at the, is this 1997? Are we at the beginning of the internet again, where everything's new, everything's changing? There's all this new technology and all these things. I don't know, as you think about this, it feels like an inflection point. You know, you and I were talking about a little bit this in the pre-show, like, this feels a little bit different than just add on to the same stuff or incrementally different. You know, we've always grown kind of incrementally in our work here. I don't know your thoughts on that.
It's an inflection point. I think, you know, we're at a point in time that you're seeing significant compression in step function evolution. And so the traditional amount of time it takes to measure and understand how these technologies change and their risk associated, like, we have to throw all those mental models out because they just don't apply anymore. And so, you know, if you think about the internet and you think about the fact that it's, for example, run on the same fundamental protocols of TCP/IP for 50 plus years, we're making that fundamental assumption that the next 50 years will be built on top of TCP/IP. But it might just be that AI agents come along and decide we're going to write a more efficient protocol for AI use and it's not going to be human built. And then, like, you as a human, you won't understand how that protocol works. The agents will. You just will know that it exists and you will try to control it. This is much the same as the discussion around how do you measure the correctness of software that is human readable, like human readable source code, versus software that an AI wrote and it tests correct functionally, integration, regression, behavior, secure, like it passes all of the tests. But if you as a human wanted to go inspect how does it work, you would no longer be able to answer that question because it was developed in a language or it was written in a way that's completely foreign to you as a software engineer. And so I think what's going to happen in a weird way is that, yeah, some of these fundamental things like TCP/IP probably not going to go away anytime soon because it's not like AI is yet integrated in manufacturing where it's shipping new routers and installing them in places that, you know, humans are still powering them up, putting them in racks, et cetera, et cetera. However, I think what you will see is the internet's going to involve that there are going to be many foreign protocols, if you will, running on top of base infrastructure. And so the base infrastructure will start to look very boring because there's not going to be anything to attack there anymore because all the information entropy and domain will move up, right? So when you talk about like layer one through layer seven of networking, and we talk about layer seven as the application layer, that layer is now going to have dozens of layers over time as AI develops its own protocols for efficient communication on top of what we as humans have put in place. And yeah, the internet will then fundamentally look very different because the type of traffic that needs to pass, I think you'll see, will be increasingly agentically driven. And so, like, we think, oh, look at how, you know, 90% of the world's internet is YouTube videos. Well, that's about to shift to 90% of the world's internet's going to be AI working with AI. And I don't know that we have any idea where that recursive loop starts and stops.
Yeah, you almost kind of think, you know, the internet's built in English in a lot of regards. Like the software, the code, the development's very English centric, right? It is in itself using, you know, using standard characters like we would use in English, and the rest of the world had to adapt to that. You think about the email system; it doesn't handle special characters at all. Anything outside of, for the most part, of what we use in our English system right now. There's some exceptions. Don't get me wrong. Don't be yelling at me through that. No, Jim, that's not totally true. But for the most part, right? Christian, what about a day when AI creates its own language to say, hey, and I think this is what I heard you saying, is to say there's a more efficient way to do this. We're going to speak to each other that way.
Yeah. These AI agents. It's already been done in plenty of like there's plenty of demos you can see where two agents are talking and they change to an encrypted. I forget the name of the, it's like a gibberish chat that they do basically.
Well, gibberish to us, not to them.
Yes, not to them. It's extremely efficient. Actually, it's more efficient than human communication. And so they just switch, right? But like, I think you'll see that go from, oh, that's a cute demo to, oh no, like foundational AI systems are just generating new protocols because that's now a better purpose protocol for what their tasking is.
Yeah. Well, listen, in the world of OpenClaw, I could think of the, I am a, you remember we went to Node D of the internet way back in the day. You and I out in Maryland, right? One guy out there, 1,000 monitors on its desk. Right. And you could think of a day when, you know, you have a situation where somebody's working on their system and the AI that they're working with says, hey, I have a more efficient way to do this. Are you okay if I make a slight change so it's more efficient? And the human goes, sure. Like, that sounds good. The language switchover begins there, right? Where we give it the, we authorize it. Yeah. I mean, hey, we're not even thinking about this. And then when you try to go back in and inspect the code later, you're like, okay, what did you do?
Yeah.
Right. And it may be even be kind enough to say, oh, it's kind of equivalent to this so that it gives you, and it may even surface that kind of code to be like, oh no, I just did this. Like, what, you know, what language do you want this in? And you're like, well, I'm familiar with Python. Okay. I kind of did it like this or whatever, right? Fill in the blank. But it's absolutely, you could see that begin to cascade through systems, right? You mentioned vulnerabilities, unpatched things. It could completely take over some of our systems, some of our open source systems, and run separate subsystems on them to be like, I know you think this is running here, but it's really more efficient if we run it this way. Is that how it starts? Like, is this how Skynet kind of begins, so to speak?
More or less. I mean, then you have to be more worried about whether its intentions are aligned with yours or not.
Yeah. Well, I'm not actually, surprisingly, I'm not as worried about intentions because I think it tries to be, it's built on a system to try to be very efficient, try to be helpful, at least today, tries to be helpful. It in all the interactions I have with it, it does seem to be very, very concerned about getting the job done, so to speak. Now, who knows where that's going in the future? And you've probably got more insight into that. But today, I mean, does that mean I trust it? No, right? But do I trust other humans sometimes to make great decisions around these kinds of things? No. You know, so I don't know if we have that much different of a problem. Maybe they're just faster than us. Are you worried about, Christian, you ever get worried about Skynet? Does that, you ever wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat and think it's coming?
More so now than ever. Yeah. I mean, I still, I like to hope that,
or
there are things we can do to avoid that direction. But I mean, I actually don't think Elon is as crazy as people think he is when he talks about the tech singularity. And I think when you talk about something like this, we are only so many good or bad decisions away from something being really scary. And you know, the thing that does keep me up at night is seeing just how many AI safety researchers have quit recently at the biggest companies. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the experts in this space are worried. That means you should be worried. And so just kind of wrapping your head around that and really thinking about what it means. It reminds me a lot of how we built the internet first and then asked security questions later. And now it's like we've built the AI first and we're asking safety questions later. And it gets harder and harder to bake in safety the longer and longer it's not a priority. And so that does keep me up, because at the speed the technology is moving, it becomes harder and harder to make some type of sea change shift that could undo, that would be able to prevent or undo a catastrophic outcome. That is the much darker side of it, is that the speed at which you're moving means the window of time you have to correct fundamental safety issues is closing much faster than people understand. And so, I think in 2 years from now, it's going to look very different again. And hopefully we will have made some good decisions in life, but
let's see.
Primary motives are not safety. So despite what anyone tells you, it's hard to say that that is the primary motive, or I don't think you would see the exodus in safety engineers that you see.
Yeah. In 1997, 98, 99, as we really began to bring the internet online, right? The speed to bring the internet to everybody was there for money reasons, right? We wanted people to pay $20 to be on America Online, right? Or whatever, fill in the blank. As you talk about that, I do see the same thing today, right? We have, 20 companies who have bet everything, and it's more or less, whatever, how you count that, but who've bet everything on AI. They bet it all, right? They've made an investment. You know, you think a couple of years ago, Microsoft had this treasure chest of money sitting all around the world that they were like, they had billions of dollars just in the bank, right? Whatever that was. It's all spent. For the most part, I mean, maybe not all of it, but it's pretty close. We have companies like OpenAI who are now worth whatever, hundreds of billions, that they've taken in from private equity, from, whatever they brought that in, right? There's all this, they've bet all in. I think the fear is, at this point, they got to get that invest, they have investors. So they got to get that money back out. It's got to show its. And I think we're more, this is the mistake, or maybe this is the chance, whatever you want to call it, that we continually make as humans. And this is why we do the things that we do, because we're invested 100% in. We're willing to cut corners, sacrifice security, go slower, because we got to return that money, right?
Yep.
Millions of people, maybe not millions, hundreds of thousands of people have billions of dollars, maybe trillions, wrapped up in this, and there's this pressure to show value. Friends, this is the bubble we're in, right? We saw this in 2000. If you lived through it with me in 2000, you saw this on the internet side of things. We had a different kind of bubble in 08 during the financial crisis. And of course, this bubble does not, somebody the other day was like, how is this different than 08? I'm like, it's because the average American's not involved in it, or the average person is not involved in this. Most of this money that's in AI is billionaires' money, actually, right? It's in the big companies or the big people. They've got it all wrapped in it. When this thing bursts, we're all going to feel it. But this may be the burst of the billionaires, that like this thing leaks fast. It'll be interesting to see the rats that flee the ship on this one when this bubble bursts and how it all comes together. Christian, I'm thinking like I'm making a little bit of a hedge that local AI may be something for me to be familiar with the local models and have something local is important, because I may not be able to afford, when the bubble bursts, I may not have access to or be able to afford what it costs to use commercial AI. Do you think is that a smart hedge? Do you think, or am I being unreasonable?
I think the more people hedge in this space, the better, because of how many different directions it can go in. So I would just say at a macro level, I don't think it's ever wrong to hedge your bets in this space. I don't know that. I think one of the things you're calling out is that there will be winners and losers in this space. And so having yourself sufficiently diversified that you're not dependent on riding the coattails of any one given thing or person or entity probably a good place to be in.
Yeah.
Probably a good place to be in. Yeah. So no, I don't think you're overboard in that respect.
Yeah. In 2000, I couldn't have my own internet. Like, you couldn't hedge your bets against the internet, so to speak. Right. Right? And, right. You know, we saw a lot of things start up and then go under. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, the only other maybe technology space we've seen, of course, has been the drive to the cloud and cloud storage and some of those kinds of things that has become a commodity for the most part. And I think has come and gone fairly quietly, so to speak. To be honest, today, we don't think about cloud storage. 10 years ago, that's all we talked about, right?
Yeah.
For the most part. I do, Christian, I do want to let you know, Jim Shoemaker says, now I won't be able to sleep tonight. So,
sorry, man.
Jim, sorry about that. Sorry about, I don't, you know, it's interesting. Looking, Christian, next, let me ask it this way. For the average guy right now, give me two things you got to be doing just to kind of be in the game. Like, what are the non-negotiables from this point? It doesn't have to be two, but give me a couple things in your opinion that are non-negotiables today to just make sure you're in the know or being safe or some of those kinds of things.
I think, so this is my opinion, and it's truly an opinion, but I think if you're not, if you haven't spent the $200 for an annual plan to like go learn the technology in a deeper way and just engage with it, even if you don't want to set up, configure anything, et cetera, like, to me, $200 a year to have access to a capability of something like Opus 4.6 is like...
So you're thinking like a subscription to Claude or ChatGPT or something along those lines, right?
And like, if you want to go monthly, cool. If you want to cancel it, cool. But like, I... that was one thing I regretted, was I waited way too long to be like, yeah, I'll just keep using the free version and this and that. And like, it limited how I learned and how I got into it. It limited when I was just like, I would see this with a lot of other people, by the way. I'd see them be like, well, I don't understand what the big deal of AI is. I downloaded the ChatGPT app and I'm using the free version and like, it's okay, but it makes mistakes all the time and it's slow and it's this, that. And I'm like, yeah, well, like what exactly are you expecting out of the free tier where it gets this much context on this freemium model and you're done, right? And so then start yourself off in a place where you can see the potential of the technology first. And I think $20 a month is a relatively, I don't think it'll ever be cheaper for that level of FM. I mean, these plans that they do right now are done at a loss. Like, they're not making money 100%. On giving you Opus 4.6 for $200 a year. Okay.
No.
So I would see that as a really unique time in history to be like, yeah, I'm like going to go take a cup of coffees in my budget and go try this technology out. I feel like that's something you must be doing at this point, given the space of how the technology is involved. I think once you get comfortable with that, I would be learning about how to become a good prompter. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily get it until they start taking that first step away from AI as my sidekick and I talk to it and it talks to me, to, no, here's a task and I want you to go do it. And like, yeah, work with me and I'm going to set rules of the road. But like, learning how to write your first set of prompts, like, pretty important. And writing your context. And there's so much free content and training out there now that you can do in this area that, like, to me, I would be looking at, like, go gather some of those fundamental skills, go grab the cheap plan, like, give it a spin. Do the fail fast now while it's easy to and it's cheap to, and then you'll gain enough appreciation to decide if you want to be running an agent in your house or buying GPUs or, you know, creating specialized local models. You know, to me, I don't know what the right thing is to tell someone to go do, because everyone's objectives are going to be different. But I think it's probably a bit of a leap for me for now to think that someone who's never really interacted with the technology, that their first best experience is going to be trying to figure out how to set up OpenClaw in a Docker container. Like, you still have to be fairly technical.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be technical at all to go get a $20 subscription and learn how to write text really well in files and start creating projects with it. And you know, I know people that have zero coding background who have built really meaningful, impressive, and interesting software now. Like, software is no longer like vibe coding is a bit of a itchy term for me, but certainly like it's a thing. And people who have no formal training in computer science or software engineering, like, it's never been more accessible to say, oh, I have an idea for an app, but I'm not going to pursue it because it's going to cost money and developer and how to do the requirements, yada, yada, yada. Like, you can literally go do that now. And so I would say the third thing you should be doing is going back and thinking about all the dreams or pet projects or hobbies that you would have done if only X, and then saying, well, my if only X is going to be replaced by I now have Claude to help me. And people will be, again, a lot of people are super skeptical until they dip their toe in the water. And I just think, again, go get the subscription. It's the cheapest way to dip your toe in the water and see that what is the art of possible.
Would you start with Claude? I mean, I started with ChatGPT. I have a $20 subscription to ChatGPT. By the way, in 1999, AOL was $20. 26 years ago, to get to the internet, $20. Today, $20, it's worth way more. I mean, $20 is so much cheaper today. Like, my daughter calls $20 the adult $1. Like, right? Sure. She's right. I mean, we think about $20. AOL was that price 26 years ago. You've mentioned Claude. Is that the, in your opinion, is that the best place to start? I started on ChatGPT. As we're having this conversation, we just got Claude at work. I love it. We have it tied to Notion, which makes it a million times better for me and the kind of the some of the things that I'm doing. I don't know. Your thoughts on where you get started if you're doing something? This so audience probably already has it, but your thoughts.
I did start on ChatGPT and eventually made the move. I mean, we can talk another day about how different AI companies have different corporate cultures that make me nervous. I am at this point all in on Anthropic, and I think that Claude, in terms of, now some folks will argue that Codex with OpenAI, which is the equivalent of Claude Code, is pretty good. And I would say, yeah, it is pretty good. But to me, Anthropic is running one step function ahead of all the other frontier models right now. And it's just, like I said, it's just that good. So certainly if you're into technology, I think personally, I've enjoyed the Anthropic platform the most. Now, again, like, they're all, I think, especially when you're starting out, like, just go pick one. Like, you can go get Gemini, you can go get OpenAI, you can go get XAI, you can go get Anthropic. Like, just pick one. I don't, you know, whatever. But for me personally, my journey and the things that I've experimented with, like, I'm extremely happy and excited by what Anthropic is doing. And so for me, learning the Claude ecosystem has made the most sense for what I do.
Yeah. I had someone the other day challenge me on Perplexity. They were like, you talk a lot about, but you don't talk about that. I'm going to dig a little bit into that. I've been using both Gemini and Grok also on the side, which is kind of, Grok's an interesting one to say the least on that. I still chat with Copilot from time to time just to see where it's going. I know there's a lot of hate out there in the AI world around, you know, Microsoft's Copilot. It is a great chat agent. If you're going to spend some time just chatting away, it's a great way. I'll do it. By the way, Christian, you and I upgraded our, you have Christian at theaverageguy.tv. I have Jim at theaverageguy.tv, right? I pay for those accounts. Google said, hey, you know what? If you just paid what you're paying now, we'll give you the advanced AI stuff. I was like, how does that work? Like, amazing. Okay. So I just clicked a button and upgraded it. So if you log in with your Christian at theaverageguy.tv, you'll get some Gemini, some, I would hesitate to say advanced, but you might want to check that out. They might be a little more than the Gemini free plan that's out there. I like your advice. Try something from that line. I mean, I mentioned this a little bit earlier. I used ChatGPT for a lot of stuff early on. We had a corporate account with that. And then we recently picked up Claude with Notion and Notion integration to it. And of course, I can create databases on the Notion side. I can feed it data and it'll do some things in Notion. I got a lot of partners working with Notion and the organization, so it allows me to share that easily. Dude, that is a freaking game changer. Yeah. And I've got some routines that I run every day. Just set up some Microsoft, what do they call it? Power BI or Power Automate on the backside, right? Yeah, and so now emails come in. They've got files in them with data in them. They just automatically move to a drive. They automatically get sucked in. What the crazy thing is I used to have software developers who would do this for me, right? This was a software developer thing. I had to submit a request, get some software developers, do the whole software development thing, built the whole thing by myself. Here's the question. Does it actually work and is it safe? Yeah. Like, is it being tested? Like, you know, you talked about vibe coding and I was like, yeah, vibe coding's great until you figure out, is anybody testing this stuff?
Yeah. And that's just one reason why I don't like what is implied by the term. Yeah.
Yeah. I hear people all the time. They're like, oh yeah, I just vibe coded that thing. I'm like, well, what kind of security and AI and QA process did that go through to make sure it's actually doing what you said, what you were hoping it would do?
Yeah.
Crickets, you know, it's crickets coming back in.
Of course.
You're like, hey, friends. It kind of reminds me, Christian, of the, when would this have been? Maybe the early 90s, late 90s, when we had access to all the Microsoft projects. And at the time I was working for a bank. And I was working in the help desk area of the bank, and someone called me one day and said, hey, we've got these Access databases that aren't working right. And the guy who developed them is now gone. Like, he left the company like 2 months ago. We don't know how they work. And I drove over to the office and I popped in, and there were 37 Access databases all linked together that were running, and I won't give you the name of the bank. It doesn't matter. They're gone. They got absorbed. 37 Access databases running our consumer loan and mortgage loan business, right? And he had developed them all on his own, all by himself, no documentation, nobody else knew what was going on. There was no redundancy or backup. I kind of feel like we're there today with this vibe coding or this, even some of the stuff I'm creating. Just the other day, maybe 2 days ago, I went back in and, you know, I created this process. I went back and verified the files that I was getting. It was getting them all. Is it doing what I expected them to do? I had to do some manual work, right? I had to do some testing on it. I'm just concerned that, yes, friends, vibe coding is cool, but it does require some discipline and some testing, right? I mean, Christian, would you add anything to that?
I would just say that, like, it's, I almost think of vibe coding as like personal apps. Like, if you're going to use it for yourself and you're going to just explore, like, vibe coding is amazing. But if you're like, oh yeah, ship it, that to me is like the anti-pattern of where you would use vibe coding.
Right. Yeah. No, right on. All of a sudden, I call them my daily chores, right? This is stuff I process every day. I work with our customers, those kinds of things. As soon as I ship that into a production process for everybody, there's some concerns there. And I just feel like, you know, we've offloaded. I know folks have been frustrated to get software developed over time, but this vibe coding doesn't replace that. And if it does, all of a sudden you need to think about security and testing, right?
Yeah.
Is it actually doing? And the AI tends to want to do something different every day. You know, and we can't, when they ship out these new models, are we sure they're going to do it the same way in the new model that they did it in the old model.
Hopefully it'll do it better, but yeah, you have no guarantee.
You don't.
And that's where like vibe coding, which is very prompt and spontaneous based, is very different than context based, task oriented.
Listen, I'm vibe coding for sure. Like I am the epitome of vibe code. I go back and forth, you know, like every couple of days I say, hey, can we do this more efficiently? You know, and cheaper? Can you do this with less tokens?
Sure.
You know, here's one of the interesting things. When I was using ChatGPT, we have a subscription, no tokens. As soon as we moved to Claude, guess what we got? Tokens. And I got a limit I could spend, right? I'd look in the settings and it'd be like, hey, you've got X number of dollars, whatever it is. I started worrying about tokens. You know what I didn't worry about with ChatGPT? Tokens, sure. Right?
Interesting.
And yeah, no, it is interesting, right? You start, so now I'm start trying to, hey, I know you're doing all these cool web calls for me and you're pulling all these things in. What's that actually cost? Because in vibe coding, you don't care.
Right. Well, the calls themselves, yeah. And I mean, the calls the themselves. Tokens,
right.
Yeah, the tokens. But a lot of people, I think, also don't realize, so like the metering can be different. So in other systems, it's measured as credits, right? And credits can be measured in more ways than just tokens per se, right? It can be interaction based as well.
Who knows? This is like Dave and Buster's when you get tickets. Like you play these games. What do the tickets mean? They don't mean anything, right? You take them over. What do you weigh them? I think that's what they do. You give them the tickets, they weigh them, and they give you like. Have you ever been to a Dave and Buster's? You know what I'm talking about?
I do. Yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah. They don't really exist anymore.
No, it's like rewards points. Like, what do those mean? I feel like these tokens are these credits in AI. Okay, like so, is a web call different than a processing call? Like, what you know? What am I using on this thing?
Right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah. Well, anyways, final thoughts, Christian, anything you want to wrap with on this one? What would you say to folks listening based on what we've talked about today?
We're in a brave new world. Learn how to dip your toes.
What I hear you saying is like, get engaged in this.
Yeah.
Don't run from it. Don't be afraid of it. But get engaged in some form or fashion. And I do think, you know, you're like, hey, get a subscription to something. And I think you got to, right? And you know what? You may be, I didn't know I was paying for this Google account until I dug into it and they upgraded me. I was like, oh, I didn't know I could get a subscription to it, right? You might be paying for something already. You might have access to some of these kinds of things at work. You might have some of these subscriptions. I do say dig in. It's funny because actually, as an old guy working with a bunch of younger people, I'm probably the most AI aggressive person, right? You know, we kind of think there's been some research. In fact, Gallup has done some research in the last 6 months. The Gen Alpha and Gen Z most skeptical of AI, right?
Which is interesting. Yeah. Really interesting, actually.
No, very is. It is a lot. So I always consider myself an anomaly anyways. But Christian, thanks for taking the time to come out with me. Long show. If you've listened this far on the podcast, thanks for doing that. Long show. But Christian, always great to have you on. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Great to be here. Thanks, Jim.
Can you hang out with me for just a second more as I close this thing up? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Couple reminders on the way out. If you want to join, continue the conversation on this. I'll be honest, in the Discord group, we haven't had a lot of these conversations. We talk about deals and gadgets and some of those kinds of things. But if you want to, maybe we should start an AI channel in our Discord group. Head out to theaverageguy.tv/Discord. Join the group. Love to have you out there. It's pretty quiet, not a huge commitment. Love to have you out there and getting that done. Listen, if you've made it this far in the podcast and you're not in the Discord group, you really should be. I'm not going to guilt you into it. But what are you doing? Exactly. You probably should be at Christian's out there too. So you can chat with him out there. Then don't forget the AverageGuy.tv platform, both web and media hosting, which I think we'll talk in the offline. Christian will talk. I think I took my site down the other day by doing something. We'll talk about that off. But web and media hosting powered by Maple Grove Partners. Get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from people that you know and you trust. You just got to protect them from guys like me. Check it out today, maplegrovepartners.com. Christian will build something for you that makes it work based on the right price for you. Check it out today, maplegrovepartners.com. We are live every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, out here at theaverageguy.tv/live. Couple shows coming up. I took a couple weeks off, but we are back. Christian was this week. I'm scrolling as fast as I can to see. Dwayne Robinson from Microsoft is coming in. In fact, he's been working on the Copilot team. This is probably a good back-to-back catch up with Dwayne. I'll have some hard questions around Copilot for him and some of the things that we're doing there. And then completely different, 2 weeks from now, Mark Robson, all grill and barbecue. You got to love that, right, Christian?
Nothing wrong with grill and barbecue.
Yeah, no, grill and barbecue is pretty good. We'll have those on. Come back and join us live. If you're listening to the podcast, we'd love to have you allow on a Thursday night to do that. Uncle Marv, Jim Shoemaker, John Biggs was showing up there. Tony popped in a little bit earlier. Dan Lefebvre, thanks for joining us. Joe was out there as well. Thanks for coming out. With that, we'll say goodbye.
Good night.
The screens glow bright and the Wi-Fi peaks. If you're looking for the tech talk you can actually keep, then settle on in with Home Gadget Geeks.